Welcome to Valley Roundup. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. The man who pushed a local snowboarder off a chairlift at Aspen Highlands in January is pleading not guilty to attempted first-degree assault by reason of insanity, but he still needs to be examined by a psychiatrist.
Everybody knows these days that these things are taking forever. Months and months and months and months because of bed space at the hospital in Pueblo. So this one is probably going to be done on an outpatient basis.
And it looks like the Shadow Mountain chairlift on Aspen Mountain will be here to stay, at least through next year's World Cup finals. In Carbondale, a student at a private high school is involved in a federal lawsuit against the government for not taking action on climate change.
The suit doesn't really lay out any sort of remedies. It just asks for a judge to order the government to do something.
In Snowmass, the town council is being asked to propose a mill levy to voters to help pay for local schools. But how far that will go is questionable.
People in Snowmass say, well, we already pay a larger percentage through our property tax, through the county. We get hit twice. It's been proposed as a fairness issue.
And as the cost of living in the Roaring Fork Valley continues to increase, local governments and voting districts are undertaking studies to see how dire the situation is. Finally, the Picken County Commissioners are worried about how edible marijuana products have been presented in the community and are considering steps to regulate it.
If you turn it into a pill, then it's just a drug. If you turned alcohol into a pill and it was just a drug and you just took a pill whenever you needed a buzz, there's no social aspect to that, and it just becomes, I want to get stoned or I want to get drunk.
Joining me this week are Roger Merolt, columnist for the Aspen Times, Madeline Osberger, contributing editor of the Aspen Daily News, John Colson, reporter for the Soper Sun, and Jason Auslander, reporter for the Aspen Times. Welcome to the studio, and John on the phone in Carbondale.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Jason, you've been on the beat at the Aspen Times on the crime beat and some of the county beat, right?
Yep.
So, why don't you tell us what's the latest in the world of crime? We had a chairlift pusher. Tell us what's going on with that case.
Yeah, the chairlift pusher pleaded not guilty by insanity to attempted first-degree assault. So that triggers a whole bunch of different things. But he was appearing in court by Skype yesterday with his lawyer and looked a ton better than he did a couple months ago when he was advised.
So what happened was this guy pushed another local off the chairlift at Highlands in what, February?
January.
And the cops kept it quiet for a little bit before they arrested him, because they were worried about what he could potentially do, right? He had made some threatening and disturbing comments.
Yeah, threatening to... They were concerned about him, I think, mostly. And once they put a mental hold on somebody, they can't talk about what they do with him. So once he was taken to the hospital in Grand Junction, they couldn't say anything, which was... And usually people who they do that for aren't there as long as this guy was. So that's why there was this very long period between when they more or less arrested him and then when they could finally identify him.
What happens next in the case?
He has to be evaluated by Colorado State Hospital psychiatrists for the insanity evaluation. Everybody knows these days that these things are taking forever. Months and months and months and months because of bed space at the hospital in Pueblo. So this one is probably going to be done on an outpatient basis, but when they get the person to be able to do it, Thomas Procell is the guy's name, will come out from the facility in Tennessee, be under the supervision of his family, and be interviewed by this doctor, probably in Denver, is what his lawyer was saying yesterday.
Was it a mitigating factor that he pushed him off at the towards the end of the lift into that powder rather than maybe over steeplechase or something where the fall would have been much more dramatic?
Only in the sense that he would have been charged with a more serious... That's why he wasn't charged with assault. He was mm-hmm. charged with attempted, because the person who was pushed, Seth, he wasn't injured. Yeah. Had he been injured, and really it's pretty lucky because I think that it could have happened at any point.
So you don't think that he looked and saw they were above powder?
No.
It could have happened anywhere.
Anywhere. Wow. And that's the scary
He's
thing.
He's lucky.
The Loge Peak lift is 60, 65 feet in the air at some point. Yeah. So the guy could have been, really, really hurt.
If he had sent him off at that moment, over the high point.
Exactly.
So Seth Becton, he got lucky.
Very lucky.
Well, the way the story was originally reported was a little humorous. The guy got pushed out of the lift, and he said he got up and saw he was okay and just skied off. He skied the rest of the day before he reported it, right?
Yeah, it was unusual the way it happened, certainly because Seth himself didn't report it. It happened at like 9:30 in the morning. He didn't report it till 3:45 in the afternoon.
No police reports on a Patter Day.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of how it was. And he said, you know, I think he was a bit traumatized. You know, he's a little bit in shock and thought, you know, his powder day instincts overtook anything else. And he thought, well, I'm kind of got up, brushed himself off. He wasn't hurt. And he thought, well, I'm not going to let this jerk ruin my powder day. So he went and did it. But the other unusual things really are that the lifty stopped the lift because saw it, because it happened right at the top. The guy who pushed him, Thomas Skeetoff. The guy couldn't do anything about that. No. He went down to look for Seth. Seth was gone by this point. So the guy's like, you know, what am I going to do? But never reported it. He didn't report it either. And there was a third guy on the chair with the two of them, and he didn't report it either.
Speaking of chairlifts, I just want to mention, you know, the Aspen Mountain closed last week, and I had asked the ski company spokesperson about Lift 1A, what the future of that was going to be. Like, do I need to be, like, having my last ride on that and recording people's experiences as a, you know, last farewell? And he said, no, you don't need to worry about that. You'll be riding that lift again. So from all appearances, that will be the lift for World Cup Finals 2017.
Well, that same spokesperson will not confirm any information that I've asked him about that lift. I mean, the rumors are that they're going to put a retaining bar on it and call it good for the World Cup Finals. I mean, right now, quite honestly, to dig up that area in advance, it's, what, 10 months out, and it would be quite the mess.
Right.
What is the retaining bar?
I think that one of the concerns about it is, you know, Roger, you being a former racer and, you know, carrying three pairs of downhill skis when you're on a chair, maybe you need a little bit of help there.
Yeah, I see that.
Or you need your Sherpa to take them up to the top of the run.
John Colson, down in Carbondale, you've had some news with oil and gas, as usual. I think this has escaped a lot of the media about a high school student being part of a federal lawsuit with oil and gas.
Yeah, John Colson here. A student at Colorado Rocky Mountain School, and we didn't find out about this until it appeared on the school's Facebook page, is part of a lawsuit. She's one of 21 plaintiffs suing the federal government over what they call their lack of action regarding climate change and the threats that climate change represents to the future of all these kids and, by extension, kids everywhere.
Who's they? The feds?
Yeah, the feds, for their lack of action. The industry has apparently been involved in this lawsuit and has filed some briefs in it, but last month a federal judge in Oregon overruled the federal the Obama administration and the industry in saying that this suit can go forward. And the suit doesn't really lay out any sort of remedies. It just asks for a judge to order the government to do something. How far it's going to go.
What was the input? I mean, who was behind this lawsuit? How did it come about?
Well, there's a couple of organizations involved. One is called Our Children's Trust, which is a group of attorneys in Oregon, primarily in Oregon, but in other parts of the country as well. And there's a climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen, who is sort of the expert witness aspect of the lawsuit, and they're the ones that put the suit together on behalf of the kids. But it all came about as a result of a request from, I don't know if you remember, when was it, like 2 years ago, a Boulder student. He's a 15-year-old kid who spoke before the United Nations and took basically world governments to task for not doing something about climate change. He is the one who, working with the lead counsel for Our Children's Trust, is sort of the instigator of this lawsuit. And the other 20 plaintiffs are just people that he's met mostly online as part of the student online community on a regional basis. They're from various parts of the country, but most of them are from Oregon.
And John, you said a judge recently said this could go forward?
Yeah, the government and the industry wanted the judge just to toss the thing out because he didn't. They didn't think there was any reality to this suit, and the judge said, "Well, no, it has sufficient merit that it can go forward."
That's amazing.
And now it's going to be heard again. It's his ruling, that judge's ruling, is going to be examined by other appeals court judges in Oregon to see whether they concur, and if they do, then it'll go on to its next step, although no one has really been able to tell me what that next step might be.
That's something like that costs a lot of money. Any idea who's putting up the money behind the organization?
Well, this outfit, Our Children's Trust, is a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. They raise money nationwide, and they're doing it all pro bono.
And have you talked to the student at CRMS?
No. She, I talked to her mother, and her mother said that the girl, her name is Jamie Butler, is a very private person and probably wouldn't talk with me, although her mother promised to contact Jamie and tell her that I was trying to get a hold of her. And her mother was right. She never called me.
In other education news, Madeline, you wrote a story about Snowmass, the town of Snowmass Village, considering putting a property tax a sales tax.
No, property tax.
It's a property tax.
Yeah, they want to raise the mill.
Okay, first it was a sales tax proposal.
Oh, well, that got shot down right away, because why add to a 10.4% sales tax as it is?
The city of Aspen has a sales tax that funds the school district.
Correct.
So they tried to get Snowmass to do that. They said no.
And back up a little bit. The school has approached the town of Snowmass three times, I believe, officially in the last year, since last April. I looked back on some of the stories I had written. And they were kind of told, well, wait till Bass Village is over. Okay, well, the school district waited till Bass Village, at least some of the hearings were over, and then they've continued. And I can't say that the reception they've received is that enthusiastic. I think that the town has finally come around to realize, or maybe has been convinced, that because 17% of the district students hail from Snowmass, they could contribute a little bit more. Now, people in Snowmass say, well, we already pay a larger percentage through our property tax, through the county. We get hit twice. But I think it's been proposed as a fairness issue. And if the Aspen voters are going to return and say, we're going to give 0.3% of our sales tax, we'd like to see some contribution stepped up from Snowmass. And that's where we are. So at the meeting the other day, I can't say that the mayor was enthusiastic. It was almost grudgingly that she agreed to this. But the problem is if they get increased property tax revenues, it's quite possible the state could say, well, we're just going to give you less money. So then we're really not ahead, and then the local community is stepping up, you know, for what? Really, for the common good, I guess, for the rest of the state.
Well, and this is John Colson. The plain fact is that most of the funding for schools, locally anyhow, comes through property taxes, and a lot of that goes for operations. So simply being a property tax hike, I don't think would require that it be spent only on capital improvement.
Well, I think the difference is that the portion of our property taxes, aside from the bond payback part of it, is it goes into the state fund, and then the state allocates
the
that
black
to schools.
Hole.
The
yes.
black hole. So everything that we put into we don't get everything out of the pot that we put into the pot.
It goes to Cortez and everywhere else that it needs to go.
Except for a specific property tax that goes to pay off a bond or that is specifically issued for our schools. So you can't just, I don't think you can raise operating expenses through property tax without a risk of the state coming in and taking it back and putting it into the general fund.
And that's disturbing. Also, they have this thing called the negative factor, which in the last couple of years, because the state, they're almost $1 billion overcommitted annually to the schools. So every year, even a poor district, relatively poor district like Leadville, they had to give the state back $1 million last year. which was just, you know, huge. And we had to give back, I think, $2.1 million to the state,
like
the Aspen district. It's because it's all related back to Tabor, the Taxpayers Bill of Rights, and the archaic way that we fund our schools. We're 43rd in the nation, I think, right now, even though we have such an educated populace. And the latest candidate, they narrowed it down for the elementary school principal to three candidates. The top one said, no, thank you. And the pay, $100,000, $110,000, I think that's probably comparable to districts where the cost of living isn't so high. The school district also produced, I think it was very interesting, in their packet the other day, showed the cost of living in Aspen 191%, I believe was the number, almost double. So, you know, I think we have to give a real hard look at these salaries if we want to retain great teachers, great principals. I mean, but where will the money come from? And that's the conundrum.
Mm-hmm. The county's doing a study on that very thing right now.
Tell us about that, Jason.
Well, they're just funding a study basically based on the same thing that Madeline's talking about salaries and retention and all of that. And the county manager made a comment about the cost of living in Pickens County being so high. The state demographer, the latest numbers are from 2013, but Pickens County is, and they kind of qualify it, and they say this isn't how much it costs to live here. This is how much it costs to buy, you know, healthcare, housing, you know, these like six different things. But basically, Pickens County is something around like $84,000, and that's the number that they're pinning to this thing. Number one, of course,
you
in the
need
state,
per capita, that's what you need to survive here.
To buy all of these six things, basically, for I think it's a family of three. Again, they qualified, and there's something else that I need to look at that's got a little bit better of a cost of living, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But this particular thing, the next one in line in the state is Summit County, and it's at like 56,000. So I mean,
Wow. It
is extremely high. It's up there.
You are listening to Valley Roundup, a look at the week's news with writers and editors in the Valley. Joining me are Jason Auslander, reporter for the Aspen Times, Roger Morolt, columnist for the Aspen Times, Madeline Osberger, contributing editor of the Aspen Daily News, and John Colson, reporter for the Soper Sun. We have a partnership with what's called RIMCOR, and we have a capital correspondent, Benta Berkland, and they came up with a data set that came from Rocky Mountain PBS, and it was a huge breakdown of cost of living and what you would need as a minimum to live in Pickens County as far as a salary goes, and I believe it's like minimum $65,000.
And it
breaks down, you know, overall wages, transportation, housing, childcare, healthcare, food, all of those costs. And then they come up with that number.
We wrote did a series last June at the Daily News, Colin and myself. And it just, I had talked to some financial planners, and the number I got, Jason, was $124,000 for a family of four. That's just to live. And anything lower than that is not living well. I think we all know how low the salaries are in Aspen and Pickens County.
It's interesting, though, because Aspen's always been a place where salaries have been low relative to the cost of living, but we always have that intangible thing called non-monetary compensation, and that's usually what drives people to move here. So,
are you talking about the barter system?
No, I'm talking about, there is the barter system, too, but just, you know, skiing and mountain biking and being outside.
Yeah.
So you wonder if this becomes more of an issue and more focus is being placed on the monetary side of this, if the non-monetary part of that compensation is becoming less valuable in terms of the quality of all the other costs.
It's becoming less valuable. I think these are just some of the realities. Of course, that those are all still, and we have free bus transportation, and we have, very safe community, which, yes, those are the intangibles. But the fact of the matter is more and more people are slipping, are falling behind.
Right, and a lot of affordable housing, and then, you know, you can live here on less if you don't pay, the market rate for to live here and that sort of thing. But
yes.
I think also this discussion kind of gets back to the closing of Little Annie's. And, you know, I was really kind of upset about it. And because pretty soon, where are you going to go?
Right. You know, one of the problems with housing, too, and this has been pointed out several times, that in the recession, a lot of the cheap ski-bum beater houses, condos, were scooped up by people as investment properties, and they were either rolled or redone, and that really took a lot of units out of the... I mean, Mick Ireland has done a study of that, and I think that, you know, we can quantify some numbers, but it's apparent. And I know a lot of the beater places that I used to have friends living in, or I lived in, no mas.
So what do you think? I mean, is it what's it gonna be like in 10 years here?
I don't know, but I mean, Colson, isn't that why you're down in Carbondale?
I think that's why a lot of people are down in Carbondale and beyond.
Right. So sure. Is it just a continual exodus from?
Yeah, I think it's getting
east?
Worse.
Yeah.
Although there's
yes.
the core of what 2,000 plus affordable units in town. It seems like the exodus is growing, and it's getting to be one of a greater and greater reach. I've talked to some people who said they have friends who moved from Aspen to Parachute mm-hmm. in order to find an affordable place to live for their family.
Right. Yeah, and then that creates all of the development pressures that you're seeing Mid-Valley and beyond.
Right.
Well, and the impact on Rafta, too. We've seen
that. And the impact on Rafta, although I think the major impact is on the number of cars going up and down Valley. It only seems to be becoming denser and denser at rush hour every year.
Yes, but we have seen a huge growth of Rafta. I don't know how many buses they can add. And as that goes farther out, and then that also begs the question about Garfield County's contribution.
We've had one trustee here suggest that Rafta just... forget about Garfield County. If Garfield County doesn't want to play, then don't send buses there. I don't think that's really a realistic option for anybody.
I don't think so either, because the Aspen benefits most from bringing people up from Garfield County. So unfortunately, or fortunately, that's an Aspen expense that should be borne.
This discussion's been going on for 20 years, at least.
At least.
Longer than 20 years.
Yeah,
but it's only been exacerbated in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it seems like it's gotten a lot worse.
Yeah. Now, the county commissioners are weighing in on edibles. Jason, if you'd like to speak to that quickly.
Yeah, I don't know how much Pitkin County makes off the marijuana industry. Certainly the city of Aspen made
inside of
a couple
Pitkin
hundred thousand
County.
Dollars off of it last year. So there isn't clearly as much in Pitkin County as there is in the city, but I think it's interesting that the commissioners have kind of prompted a conversation about edibles and whether they should be anything but a pill, and whether the fact that they are currently in any number of forms, sodas and cookies and popcorn and gum and sausage and
ice cream, chips.
You know, what kind of message does that send? And is it necessary? They're worried that it's sending the wrong message. And also, I think I hadn't really ever heard the conversation. You know, you kind of think about it and you get to the point, well, I guess if you want to eat it, what's the difference? Just take a pill and does it matter?
Well, it's an interesting argument, but it sort of takes the social aspect out of it. And really, when it comes to drinking or you know, ingesting or taking marijuana, however you want to take it, isn't the social part of it the part that's least dangerous? If you turn it into a pill, then it's just a drug. Mm-hmm. If you turned alcohol into a pill and it was just a drug and you just took a pill whenever you needed a buzz, there's no social aspect to that, and it just becomes, I want to get stoned or I want to get drunk.
But ingesting alcohol, I mean, there you don't eat it.
No, I know,
there's
but
no
you
other
drink
way.
It. But you
drink
sit,
it,
you
right?
Sit around
I
the dinner table and have a drink,
glass of wine,
and it's very social. It's you know, it's not all about getting a buzz. But if it was just a pill, it's like, okay, I just.
Well, I think the part of the commissioner's point is exactly what you said: is that, you know, if you take it as a pill, it is a drug, and guess what? It is a drug.
So it is a drug.
You know,
to be,
so and that's kind of their point in this. And I don't know the social aspect of eating a marijuana cookie. I mean. Or drinking a marijuana soda. I don't know. I mean, passing a joint around, smoking it, I see that as, you know, obviously that's got a social aspect to it. But eating it, unless you're having like one of these marijuana dinners
right.
Well, take the drink. You have a marijuana drink or a beer. You know, you sip it slowly and you talk and you look at the sunset, whatever you're doing.
I suppose.
It's just it's just different, I think.
Well, I think, you know, Pandora's box is open at this point. You're not going to ban. You're not going to ban edibles.
And that's
but,
what the county's suggesting. What are the commissioners talking about exactly?
Well, where they are right now is they've already denied one woman's kitchen, and they're waiting for the Valley Marijuana Council, which is a group co-founded by the sheriff DeSalvo, to make some recommendations on edibles to them. And there's actually another application coming from a Denver company that wants to make sausage at their factory in Denver, have the USDA inspect that sausage in Denver, and then ship it to Aspen and have it be infused with oil, cannabis oil, right, and then sell it. And obviously it's not going to be inspected by anybody here because the feds can't inspect marijuana things. And not that that's a concern, but I think some of these people that are putting these applications in are not paying attention to what the commissioners are telling them, mm-hmm. you know, and it might help to go and pay some attention to that.
Are the commissioners concerned about – what's their basic concern here?
Their basic concern is kids.
Okay.
And what kind of message that it's sending, and that has that further thinking, I think, partially prompted by Joe DeSalvo – gets them to the point of, you know, why are these various products that are gummy bears and cookies and candy and things like that that are, you know, appeal to kids the way that edibles are sold now?
This is John Colson. Have always interested me because I remember back when I was a kid, it's been a long time, but I can vaguely remember it, and I know it hasn't changed from that time. If you wanted to get some pot, you could. And all these efforts to try to restrict the industry strike me as futile, because if kids want to get it, they'll get it. And now that the voters in the state have given adults the constitutional right to eat it, drink it, smoke it, whatever, it seems to me that these efforts are basically going against the will of the voters once again, because they've done it before, and I don't get it.
Well, I think again, it's a drug or it's maybe not a drug. You know, that's their question.
Oh no, it's a drug.
Well, clearly, but if it's marketed as a cookie, then maybe it's marketed somewhat not as a drug, and I think that's their point.
No,
but again, well, I agree with you. It is somewhat an exercise in futility.
And. It seems kind of silly. Anybody who's going to buy a marijuana-infused product is going to know that they're buying a marijuana-infused product.
Well,
because it looks like a cookie, they're not going to say, wow, this is just a cookie.
Well, if it's sitting on the counter, unwrapped from its package, there is no way to tell the difference. Although, as we were talking
about...
Well,
that's right. That's a problem with parental intelligence.
Well, parental or whatever, I mean, depending on who leaves it around. But I guess there are some regulations now that say that all of these things need to be stamped somehow, THC.
Like a brand.
You know how you stamp popcorn or sausage or, you know, cookies, for that matter. I don't know how you do that, but that's certainly part of the thinking of the commissioners. They were talking about, you know, maybe make it all dyed green or something like that.
Well, if you have cookies and gummy bears and things like that infused with THC, it becomes a problem in the schools too. I mean, kids can eat that at lunchtime and right in front of the teachers, and
nobody
is the wiser.
Well, on that note, we're out of time. So thank you for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having us.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of Valley Roundup. Thanks to Jason Auslander, reporter for the Aspen Times, Roger Marolt, columnist for the Aspen Times, Madeline Osberger, contributing editor of the Aspen Daily News, and John Colson, reporter for the Soper Sun. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.